plushcare.com. Healthcare that makes you smile. Virtual primary care and mental health treatments when you need it. Get personalized, high-quality healthcare by talking to top U.S. medical doctors, all from the ease of your smartphone. Care for you and the ones you love most. High quality. Our highly skilled online doctors are trained at the top U.S. medical schools with an average of 15 years experience. Our online doctors give you and your entire family the peace of mind you should expect from your healthcare provider. Convenient? Just book an appointment, that chat via video on your smartphone, and pick up your prescription from your pharmacy. Our advanced technology is integrated with most major insurers, labs, and pharmacies. Affordable? Talking to an online doctor has never been easier and more affordable. For just your copay or just $99 per visit, you can get quality care from one of our highly skilled online doctors. We are in network with most major insurers in the U.S. and provide care in all 50 states. Over 450,000 patients cared for. Good morning. Hope you had a good week. Here is Chapter 20 of American Dirt by Janine Cummins. Later that night, when the initial wash of shock has lost its bite and the sisters are beginning to feel calm beneath the news distress of the terrible news, Lorenzo shows up at the shelter. Lydia is helping in the kitchen, stirring a huge pot of beans on the cooktop when she sees him through the open door to the large dining room. From a distance, he's not as menacing as he had appeared on the train. He's not as tall, not as bulky as his first impression would have suggested. Like every other migrant here, he looks bone-weary and relieved to be indoors where the aroma of a hot meal greets him. Still, Lydia instinctively moves her body out of his line of vision and actually drops a long wooden spoon into the vat of beans. "Carajo," she says out loud. She presses her eyes and mouth closed for a moment, and when the woman who runs the kitchen notices, she tells Lydia not to worry. She hands her a pair of tongs so she can fish the wooden spoon out of the beans. Lydia helps serve the dinner too on paper plates, and the migrants have to line up cafeteria style for their food. When Lorenzo comes through and Lydia ladles a spoonful of beans onto his plate, he nods at her without making eye contact, without further comment, and that strange behavior makes Lydia even more afraid. Has she offended him, provoked him to change his mind about letting them be? "Would you like a little more?" she asks him, but he's already moved along to the rice station. The sisters and Luca are behind him in line, and while they are waiting, Solda feels a hand slip beneath her arm and grope her breast. It's so fast, like a sparrow. Her whole body recoils from that hand, but then she whips her head around to confront her offender. There are three migrant men all standing there facing one another. They are so deep in conversation and so oblivious to her presence that there is no way to determine who it was that grabbed her. Their disinterest is so convincing that Soledad finds herself wondering if she imagined the violation. "No," she does herself, "I am not crazy." She grinds her teeth and claps her arms in front of her. She keeps her body hunched into a warning. After dinner, everyone gathers in La Sala to watch television, but not Lorenzo. Lydia doesn't know if she's relieved or concerned about his absence, as both. She wants to keep an eye on him and hopes to never see him ever again. On TV, no one wants to watch the news because it's all too familiar, so they put on Lil Simpson at home. Mimi doesn't like Luca watching Lil Simpson because she thinks Bart is rude, and she doesn't want Luca to start saying things like "Come te mis calzoncillos." But what Mimi doesn't know is that Luca and Pepe used to watch it together all the time when she wasn't home, and Pepe was stretched out on the couch with his shoes off and his toes wiggling in his socks. Luca would drape himself across Pepe's chest like a blanket, and Pepe would rub Luca's back while they watched. It was their secret ceremony. They'd imitate their voices, and Pepe would keep the remote control close by so if Mamie came in unexpectedly, he could change the channel to Arte Nina real quick. Luca doesn't like watching Lil Simpa here in this tiled room with his fluorescent lights and everyone sitting on folding chairs with their arms crossed on and their shoes on. He endures it by unlacing and relacing his sneakers three times, and then it's over. When it's over, Mamie suggests to Soledad and Rebecca that they might all say a rosary together for the full restoration of their father's health. Also, she knows the practice will serve to calm her nerves, to soothe her agitation before she attempts to sleep. They retreat to the corner of the room where the tables are, and several other women join them. The sisters are grateful, and it's the first time in Luca's life that the rosary doesn't feel like a chore. He listens to the chanting voices of the gathered women, first his mother's Sloan cadence, "Blessed are you among women," and the chorus of response, "Pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen." Ultra vase. Luca holds his tombstone rosary in both hands and he counts out the prayers. He squeezes the stones between his fingers so hard their shapes are temporarily etched into the press of his skin. He wonders if her brother ever did that, wonders how many times she passed these stones through the grasp of her aged hands, and when that thought occurs to him, he can nearly hear her brother's voice coming to the chorus. Santa Maria Madre de Dios. There's a catch in his throat, so he can't speak, can't add his own voice to the prayer, but it's okay, because listening to it is its own kind of reverence. And in any case, he feels the energy flowing out of the beads and into his fingertips like a throb, like a heartbeat. The rosary is a kind of tether, and if he clings to it tightly enough, it will preserve his connection to Abuela and Adrian, to all of them, to Acapulco, to his little bedroom with the bolón de football lamp and the blanket with the race cars on it, to home. Luca closes his eyes and listens to the chain of prayers that binds him to Pappy. All the while, there's a new posture about the sisters that softens them into a diminished curl. When Luca opens his eyes and emerges from his own thoughts, he recognizes that posture because it's familiar to him. It's relatively new to Mamie, too, and Luca thinks of it as a grief curl. He feels truly sorry for the sisters' anguish and for Mamie's, so he asks God to alleviate their suffering. That night, Luca sleeps the best kind of sleep. He sleeps without dreaming. That Lydia and Luca will travel and with Soledad and Rebecca for as long as possible has not been detailed aloud. Yet it's an arrangement all four of them intuitively understand. So much has happened that each hour of this journey feels like a year, but there's something more than that. It's the bond of trauma, the bond of sharing an indescribable experience together. Whatever happens, no one else in their lives will ever fully comprehend your ordeal of this pilgrimage. The characters they've met, the fear that travels with them, the grief with the sick that eat at them, the collective determination to keep pressing north. It solders them together so they feel like an almost family now. It's also true that selfishly, strategically, Lydia hopes the addition of two extra people to their traveling party might serve as an extra layer of camouflage. Might confuse anyone who at first glance suspects she might be the dead reporter's missing widow. Before sleep, Lydia closes the ugliest box in her mind and instead allows herself to think forward to Estados Unidos. Instead of Denver, she thinks of a little white house in the desert with thick adobe walls. She's seen pictures of Arizona, cactuses and lizards, the ruddy red landscape and hot blue sky. She pictures Luca with a clean pack back and a haircut, getting on a big yellow school bus and waving at her from the window. And then she conjures a third bedroom in that house for the sisters, Soledad's new baby, perhaps a girl, the smell of diapers and a bath in the kitchen sink. They're all eager to get clear of Lorenzo, Lydia most of all. So even though the shelter is comfortable and they are weary, and were he not here, it would be tempting to stay another night or two. In the morning, Luca, Lydia, Soledad, and Rebecca rouse themselves while still dark out. They are careful to creep past the men's bunk room without making a sound. They leave before dawn. Lydia feels a tremendous sense of urgency about getting out of Guadalajara. And it's not only because of Lorenzo. This city is a Venus flytrap, and she sees evidence all around as they rush through the indigo pre-dawn streets. Migrants come here with a momentum on their way to El Norte, and they may find a welcome, a slice of comfort, some relative safety away from the rest, so they stay an extra day to catch their breath. Then three more, then 100. Look there, sleeping stretched out on a piece of cardboard in a disused corner of a parking lot, a shoeless mother and toddler in dirty clothing. There, with his eyes glazed and a brown paper bag of God knows what clutched tightly in his fist, a skinny teenage boy, track marked and bruised. There, and there, so many young girls tottering on heels in shadowy places, the whites of their eyes glowing brightly against the gloom. Lydia hustles Glucka and the sisters gone away from the shelter and toward the tracks where the light around them grows towards sunrise. For Soledad and Rebecca, on the other hand, there's some increased measure of reluctance about this leg of journey because they learn from a woman at the shelter left at the table soon cross into the state of Sinaloa. A place that's famous among migrants for two things, its expertise at disappearing girls and the vigor of its cartel. Still, there's no way to get to El Norte without passing through some place that's famous for those things, and they chose the famed Pacific route specifically because it's the most secure, so this is perhaps the most dangerous leg of the famous route. In any case, the sooner they set out, the sooner they'll be past it. Soledad also has a new, increased sense of determination. What happened to Pepe will not have been in vain. So she is desperate to get to El Norte now to make a life there that is good and golden, a life that will honor her family's sacrifices. But there's an urgent sense of disquiet among them as they move northwest along the tracks, listening to all the time for the hopeful sound of a train at their backs. Lydia looks over her shoulder compulsively now, and when at length the train approaches, they board easily without even much forethought or communication. That fact startles Lydia when she reflects. We didn't even have to think about this, too. She says this all that when she was as Lucas safely belted onto the grating. We're becoming professional, Soledad answers, but Lydia shakes her head. No, we're becoming apathetic. Soledad frowns. It's not just get used to it, though, right? We adapt. Lydia touches on a thick strand of Lucas' hair that sticks out from beneath his father's baseball cap. It's too long. This hair. She curls one of the thick black curls around her finger. And in attendance of that act, she's momentarily transported back to her mother's garden, leaning over Sebastian's lifeless body, the handle of the bent spatula digging to her knee. She had touched her husband's forehead and the coarseness of his hair, still growing from his follicles, and tickled her wrist. Sebastian's shampoo with a scent of mint. A solitary sob rises up from Lydia's bones and is lost in the rumble of the train beneath her. She turns her eyes from looking and look at Soledad. From now on, when we board, each time we board, I will remind you to be terrified, Jesus. And remind me, too, that this is not normal. This is not normal. Soledad nods. The sky begins to brighten above them, and a ribbon of pale orange expands on the horizon. But it's still twilight where the tracks meet the earth. There's a handful of other bodies on top of the train, but it's not nearly as crowded as yesterday. And although that fact might be explained by the earliness of the hour, it serves to underscore Lydia's sense that Guadalajara has siphoned off some of their numbers. She feels her chest opening with something like relief as the train moves away from the city. A half hour north and landscape is commandeered by miles of squat, spiky plants that stretch into the distance along both sides of the tracks. There are gray-green fronds like a million waving hands, and the train slows slightly at the outskirts of a town where the buildings are quaint and well-kept. Lydia notes the sweet, sticky aroma of fermenting agave plants, tequila on the car behind them. Two migrants climb down a side ladder and wait for a safe place to jump off. Lucca tries to watch them, but the train turns and the men disappear, and Lucca has to contend himself without proof that they landed safely. He has to create what truth with only the determination of his mind. The train thunders on toward Tepic, toward Acapulnita, toward El Rosario for a long time. Then they pass nothing at all, just grass and dirt and trees and sky. The occasional building, a rare cow, is pastoral, beautiful, and the morning air is fresh. Lydia feels the church's pang of some mother delight, a bewilderment of migrant as fleeting tourists as if they're on vacation looking out across some exotic landscape. It's brief. Despite the growing distance between herself and Lorenzo, the pick of his presence remains. It's alarming that he found them so easily, so accidentally he hadn't even been looking. But Javier is looking with all his considerable resources, with all his collections. Lydia turns her face to the south, ridiculously as if she'll see him standing there atop the train, as if he'll push his glasses up on the bridge of his nose approach her. It won't happen like that. She knows when he comes for them, it won't be him. Wearing a smile on the cardigan, clutching a volume of poetry to his chest, it'll be some faceless assassin, some boy in a hoodie. Holding the dispatch of her death, ill Sicario won't feel anything when he delivers a bullet that murders her son. Liz might be a hamster on a wheel. She knows her execution might already be on this train, but she wills it to move faster regardless, that they might outrun that selfie of Lydia with Javier. As it pings its way from phone to phone all the way across Mexico, Lydia shrinks between the scissors. She slips her finger to side. She slips her finger inside Sebastian's ring. At the tiny village surrounded by mango orchards, while Bestia crosses without notice into Sinaloa, Soda is stretched out, her pack tucked beneath her as a pillow, and her fingers wrapped into the grating. Her face looks awash in a sickly gray. How are you feeling? Lydia asks. The vocabulary of her former life is inadequate now, but it's all she has. Soda opens her mouth, but then closes again without answering, and shakes her head. Well, when I was pregnant with Luca, I was helped with the nausea, she says quietly. Then her mind does a litany of counter-arguments. When I was pregnant with Luca, I was not 15 years old. When I was pregnant with Luca, I did not have to travel thousands of miles on top of a freight train. When I was pregnant with Luca, he was not conceived by rape. Olives, Solod grimaces, readjusts her chin on her backpack and closes her eyes, but it's no use. After two deep breaths, she lunges for the side of the train and vomits over the edge. Rebecca watches her eyes wide with worry. Then she hands her pack to Saluka and crawls across to her sister. She rubs the small of Solda's back and waits for the retching to subside. There's a brandy cut to the air as the tracks draw near to the ocean. Mango groves give way to palm trees and sandy soil, and outside a tiny village, a couple dozen migrant men have made a large camp. They cheer when they see the train approaching, but the beast doesn't slow. It's moving too fast for them to board, so the men stand to despondent, watching it thunder past. Luca waves and a few wave back. Most reclaim their positions in the canty shade to rest while they wait for the next train, but one man decides to try. He runs alongside the tracks while the others watch. They shout and whoop at him, a lot of competing noise, conflicting advice. He manages to get one hand up on the passing ladder, but his legs can't keep up. His arm is snug, but the legs hang down. The watching men yell louder and more frantically. Luca maybe tries to draw attention away, but he's leaning over to watch, transfixed by the dangling man. They all are. It's clear he won't make it, that he can't haul himself up from that position. One arm binds him to the philosophy of La Bestia. They all hold their breath. The man's face is tipped up so Luca can see his expression the moment he shifts from determination to acceptance. For a moment beyond that, he delays letting go, so Luca has the impression the man is savoring it. These final seconds wait when his life is intact. When at last his grip fails and he falls, there's still a hope briefly that he'll land clear of the tracks. That happens sometimes, a fluke of lucky physics and biology, but no. The man is sucked in beneath the wheels of the beast. His mangled screams can be heard above the sounds of the turning train. Luca looks back and sees the migrants gathering in a knot in the tracks behind them, assesses the pieces of the severed man. Lydia does not cry for that wounded man, but she does pray for him. She prays that he won't survive his mutilation, that merciful death comes quickly for him. More fervently, she prays that whatever impression the incident has on Luca, it won't cause him any further harm. Surely her son may soon reach a limit of what a resilient child might endure without triggering some permanent internal decay. Don't worry, Amorcito, she tells him. That man will be fine. Look at Rochas. He was in two pieces, Mamie. Her voice is light. That's what doctors are for. She feigns confidence in a way all mothers know how to do in front of their children. She wears the fierce maternal armor of deceit. She lasts only a moment to pass before she changes the subject, turning to Rebecca. So what will you girls do when you get to the border? You have a plan? How to cross? Yes, our primo went last year into Arizona, and then he got a ride from here to Maryland. That's where he lives, and we're going to stay with him. We're using the same route, the same coyote. How did he find the coyote? Lydia is constantly reminded that her education as a purchaser, that she has no access to the kind of information that is real currency on this journey. Among migrants, everyone knows more than she does. How do you find a coyote? Make sure he's reputable, pay for your crossing, all without getting ripped off. Thankfully, Rebecca is flush with insight. Most of the people from our village used him before. He was recommended because you can't just pick any coyote. A lot of them will steal your money and then sell you to the cartel, you know. Lydia has never met a coyote. It's possible she's never even met anyone who's met a coyote. You should use our guy, Rebecca says, unless you already have one lined up. Lydia shakes his head. We don't. Rebecca smiles, so we can go together. Mi primo says our. He says this guy is the best. It took him only 2 days of walking, and then somebody picked him up in a camper van on the other side and drove them to Phoenix. Gave them bus tickets from there to wherever they were going. It's a lot of money, but he's safe. How much money? Lydia asks. Rebecca looks at Soledad, who's still lying down, her head resting in her folded arms. Rebecca turns around to suspect. How much, Sol? Soledad answers without lifting her head or prying her eyes. 4,000 each. Lydia is startled by the sum. I thought it would be much more than that. Like 10,000 pesos at least. Dollars, Soledad answers, her voice muffled by the sleeve of her shirt. $4,000. Dios santo, Lydia does a quick intake of breath. She accepts dollars into the bookstore, so she's familiar with the typical exchange rates, but not in these quantities. She strains to do the math in her head. It's a lot of money, but they have enough. They have plenty. They will even have a small sum left to get them started on the other side, but then she remembers the Padre's pep talk in Celaya. Every single one of you will be robbed. Everyone, if you make it to El Norte, you'll arrive penniless. That's a guarantee. But it's good anyway to have a plan to look beyond what they might eat today or where they might sleep tonight. Lydia doesn't feel ready for it, but she's beginning to consider the future. She's definitely not ready to look back, though, and she hopes she might accomplish one without necessitating the other. So where do you meet this coyote? He's expecting you, she asks. Rebecca? Yes, his name is El Chaca. Of course it is, Lydia thinks. Why would a coyote be named Roberto or Luis or Jose when he can be named the Jackal? And he works out of Nogales. When we get there, we call his cell phone. Look, Rebecca loosens a rainbow wristband where she wears on her left arm and sticks her finger into a tiny on the inside. From there, she unrolls a scrap of paper with the coyote's phone number on it. Good, Lydia knows. Okay, so now they have a solid plan. It's amazing that riding atop of a freight train can become boring, but it's true. The tedium is spectacular. The chugging of the engine and the squeal of the metal are so constant that the migrants no longer hear those things. At towns where the train slows or stops, migrants get off, migrants get on, and they continue. The sun hikes high into the sky and glares down on them until their skin is so hot they can smell it, a little charred, and the brightness of the light bleaches the colors of the landscape. They pass through Mazatlan without stopping, where the tracks run alongside the ocean for a while, and they listen to sand there, and the blueness of the sea reminds Luca of home, which makes him feel obliterated instead of cheered. He's glad when they turn inland and leave the beach behind. But then it's back to hours of tedium, blended brown and green and gray, so it's almost a welcome diversion when a few miles outside Culiacan, the monotony is broken by screaming. A lone voice repeats the words over and over like a siren. La migra, la migra. All around them, these migrants grab their things quickly. Some don't even bother with that. They look the ones at the dust trails kicked up by the tires of the approaching trucks, and they oppose the opposite side of the train, and they bail. Come on, Soledad, wake up, Rebecca says, her voice tight with panic. We have to go. The train is slowing but hasn't stopped, and the men on top aren't quitting. They scatter, they bolt. Hola, mierda, con esta. Soledad curses, slinging her pack onto her shoulders. What's happening, Mamie? Luca asks. In third, La Migra is no threat to Lydia and Lopa, as Mexican nacionals they cannot be deported back to Guatemala or El Salvador. And unlike most of their fellow migrants, they aren't in the country illegally. They're committing only the minor infraction of riding the train, so perhaps it's only the pervasive panic all around them. Perhaps it's contagious, but no, Lydia just knows. She can tell that Los Agentes de la Migra in their uniforms are not here to enforce law and order. She knows by the bone-deep fear born only of instinct that she can only rely on their citizenship now to protect them. They are in mortal danger. She can feel it in her pores, in her hair. The trucks converge like pack animals. The men outside are masked and armed. Lydia scrambles frantically at the buckle on Lucas' belt, but her hands are shaking and she asks to try three times before she can free him. Mamie, Lucas' voice is rising in pitch. Hers is low. We have to run. Thank you for listening to this chapter. Have a good week and stay safe.